There are now at least four current or former senior officials with the city and county of Honolulu who are under scrutiny by federal agents. Former police chief Louis Kealoha and his wife, former deputy prosecuting attorney Catherine Kealoha, were indicted on charges of fraud, conspiracy, identity theft, and more. Since those charges were filed last March, the probe has widened to include Honolulu's chief prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro. An impeachment petition has been circulating and is now before a circuit court judge. Earlier this week, the ripples in the federal investigation reached Honolulu Hale, affecting City Corporation Counsel Donna Leong. Here is Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell making the bombshell announcement.
Donna Leong, who's our city's corporation counsel, as you know, has received a target letter in relationship to the FBI's Kealoha investigation. I understand that it involves the separation agreement with the former chief of police, Louis Kealoha, and monies paid to the chief as part of that agreement. I don't know any more than that. You know, and a target letter must be taken very seriously, and we take it very seriously. But at the same time, I believe Donna is entitled to a presumption of innocence. I believe it's enshrined in our Bill of Rights, in our United States Constitution. And I continue to have full confidence in Donna Leong, not only as the attorney and chief legal officer for the City and County of Honolulu, but also as a person who's an important member of my cabinet. And as we all know, Donna has done some exceptionally good work in some very difficult cases over the last 6 years. However, to avoid any distraction that a target letter brings, Donna, at her suggestion, and I have mutually agreed that she will take a leave of absence with pay while she resolves this matter, and I hope she can do so within a relatively short period of time.
Following that statement, Caldwell was asked when Leong received that target letter.
So she got the letter on the 3rd of January, and she told me almost immediately. And we were ready to announce it, and she asked, could she have time to retain a lawyer? And I thought, in fairness, we should give her that time. She has now retained a lawyer. A decision was made now that she had the lawyer to make the announcement, and we plan to make the announcement today, last week, calling in her cabinet first to tell them. And I understand that Don Leong also informed all her lawyers in her department. So we did it, I think, within a reasonable period of time, giving deference to both Donna and enough time to retain a lawyer so that lawyer can respond to your questions.
Donna Leong officially went on paid leave this past Monday, January 14th. So what does it really mean to be named in a target letter? Here to help us unpack that is Ken Lawson. Ken teaches criminal procedure and criminal law at the University of Hawaii's Richardson School of Law and is co-director of the Hawaii Innocence Project. He's also a former defense attorney who has represented clients who have received target letters.
If you look at it from a macro perspective, if you look at, like, let's say the Mueller investigation, people keep saying, you know, when is it going to be over, when it's going to be over? You know, it seems to continue to go on and on and on. And what happens is once sometimes in these federal investigations, whether it's a drug conspiracy ring or any type of white-collar crimes, once you start pulling strings, you just keep pulling it and stuff just keeps shaking loose. And so, again, I think what's amazing is not just how long the investigation is taking, but the different routes it's now hitting. And, you know, when you talk about high-level officials that it's now touching, it's quite extraordinary.
I wonder, too, how the rest of the country is looking at this.
It may be a surprise because it's Hawaii, you know, and I think at least I have, you know, I've been here for almost 11 years now. And so being a transplant from the mainland, it wouldn't be unusual if we're talking about Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Los Angeles, you know what I mean, Detroit, who currently has a mayor serving prison sentence, New Orleans. But there's something about Hawaii that I think has captured the nation's attention with respect to this case. And the fact that you have, you know, the former chief of police, a high-ranking prosecutor who happens to be his wife, and the prosecutor for Honolulu receiving a target letter.
And now the top civil attorney.
And now the top civil attorney, which is, you know, coming straight out the mayor's office. I think that's the reason why you will see it grab national attention, because of where it's happening, i.e. Hawaii.
Now, in the case of Donna Leong, based on what the mayor said, that they're looking at the severance, the process under which the severance was set aside for the police chief, what's your sense of what they're looking at there?
You know, that I remember when this happened, and I was really shocked that the city was settled with a person who was about to be indicted. But I think what's even more concerning is, you know, because a target letter says not only were you doing something unethical, right? What a target letter is saying is, listen, we got evidence that there's been criminal activity, and we have enough evidence, we believe, to charge you with it. Now, if you want to come in and talk to us about it, that's fine, but you're subject, you're the target of a grand jury investigation, and we believe right now we have enough evidence to charge you with a crime. So it's pretty serious. And so, you know, it's kind of baffled me, you know, what could have went on? Because, again, with being the chief lawyer for the city, you have authority to settle cases. And so, you know, I'm at a loss as to what could have been any type of criminal conduct other than some type of structuring. In other words, trying to structure a settlement in a way that could be considered criminal. You know, I think it's kind of mind-boggling. This one passed on me for a twist, and I practiced law for almost 20 years in the federal system and the state system. So, I'm just be honest with you, I have no idea other than some form of structuring. In other words, I'm trying to tell you that this is what this settlement is for when I know it's for something else. Or this is, you know, how we're going to settle the case when I know that that's not on the surface how this case is being settled. And so it's like sometimes you can put money, like you can structure a settlement to where, or structure the deposits in a bank account, right? Let's say I give you $100,000 and you don't want to report that I gave you $100,000. So you're structuring it in a way in different bank accounts so that the IRS doesn't get tipped off that you somehow owe them money. That, you know, so it doesn't matter where the money came from. That money could be a legitimate source. It doesn't have to be drug money or any other type of money that could be subject to a civil forfeiture. But if you structured trying to evade detection from the IRS, it can get you in a lot of trouble. And so, again, I have no idea what it could be, which makes us even more curious and even more amazing.
It is a head-scratcher because, from what I understand, the city council didn't really approve the settlement.
The question becomes, should that responsibility be civil, you know, an ethical responsibility that you know, it gets filed with the Ethics Commission here? Or is your violation? That's what's really amazing is because, again, the target letter is from the federal prosecutor basically saying you're the subject of a grand jury investigation because your behavior, we believe, is criminal. And so, you know, so again, it could be some type of fraud to where, you know, city council and the police commission, when they settle the case, believe that we're settling this case in this particular manner for these reasons. But the facts are that somehow you didn't disclose to us where the money was going and what the real purpose of this money was for. And had we known that, we would have never authorized this settlement. And because you weren't honest with us in what this settlement money was for and how the settlement money was supposed to be used, we believe you committed a fraud. That's where this could be going. But again, like I said, I have no idea other than the fact that it has to be serious in order for that target letter to come, because they could have issued her a subject letter. And prosecutors do a subject letter to you when they say, look, there may have been some unethical conduct going on. We have no idea if it's criminal. We're investigating it. Could be criminal, could be civil. But we have some evidence that you were involved in some type of conduct that's bothering us. Can you come down and tell us so we can straighten it out? Mm-hmm. That's a different letter than what she got. She got a target letter, which is already telling you we've got evidence that there was a crime, and we believe you committed this crime.
People are drawing the parallels between the situation with Donna Leong, and she's hired an attorney, and then Keith Kaneshiro, who, as far as we know, has not. The office isn't talking, so we're not really sure what the status is, but he has not stepped away.
And is your question, should he step away?
Yeah, I mean, what is the law school thing?
Yeah,
I mean,
but the law, he has his discretion. You know what I mean? And so, if I'm, you know, when I represented people that received target letters, if they were private individuals, then I would say, no, you don't have to step away from your private job, you know, because stepping away may give the public the impression that you're guilty of something. And so even though you received a target letter, you know, we're going to enter a plea of not, we're going to tell them we're not guilty, we didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not leaving my position. But for Keith, it's different. I mean, you're the prosecutor, and the prosecutor's role is to make sure that justice is being done and to protect society from criminal wrongdoing. And when you're the subject of criminal wrongdoing and what you're alleged to have engaged in with respect to criminal acts occurring in your office, I think you have a duty to those people that elected you to step away so that everybody can know that, that what's going on is above board. I think you have a duty to say to us, you know what, I want you to know I didn't do anything wrong, but I'm going to step away so that everybody understands that justice is being done. And I think that his duty is greater in that sense than any other private individual that receives a target letter from the federal prosecutor's office.
I do think that lots of folks are looking at this case and thinking, well, these are our top city officials here, and they ought to be held to a higher standard.
Absolutely, because if I'm on a police force, if I'm a young prosecutor, or if I'm a young civil attorney working for the city of Honolulu, and everybody above me is doing things that's not right, then why shouldn't I? Why can't I cut corners? You know what I mean? Why can't I pull people over even though I don't have probable cause? Why can't I just start arresting people that my neighbors because I don't like them? Why can't I set my, you know, I mean, how do you tell me, or how can you discipline me when you yourself are doing wrong? And so, again, I think, if anything, it just needs to be rooted out. And sometimes things have to get worse before they get better. But again, the shock, I think, nationwide is that it's going on here in Hawaii because everyone's visual of Hawaii is, you know, a place of paradise, a place where people don't just screw over each other. You know what I mean? People save their last dollar for years to come here on vacation. And so when you see this type of corruption, it sends a huge, you know, sound wave throughout the nation with respect to justice. I mean, it really is concerning. But I, getting back to it, I think that you have to, you know, you have to root it out.
Right.
To root it out.
We do have a system of, you know, innocent until proven guilty. We have two indictments, and the trials have yet to work through the system on that. I think there was even a motion to delay Catherine Kealoha's trial.
Getting back to your point, so if you're a prosecutor, a federal prosecutor, and you're going after a lawyer, just like we saw with Michael Cohen, before they were able to get a search warrant, the FBI got a search warrant on him, that judge went through everything he or she could to make sure, because it's such a precedent-setting thing to search a lawyer's office. So think about this. When you're talking about sending a subject letter to the prosecutor of Honolulu, when you're talking about indicting the former chief of police and his wife, who's a high-ranking, you have more than enough evidence. It's not like you know what I mean? You better make sure that you dotted all your I's and crossed all your T's.
Yeah. Would have been interesting to be a fly on the wall during those discussions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think that's what's more upsetting is in order for that target letter to be issued, you can bet your last dollar that there's evidence there that the prosecutor believes shows crimes, or he would have never issued it to such a high-level official, knowing the ripple effect it would have throughout our state.
There's also the issue of payment, right? I mean, so do the taxpayers then end up footing the bill for Conoscero's defense or for Donna's defense?
Yeah, that's concerning too, right? I mean, again, that was a big deal with when the chief entered into his settlement. And I think it's wrong for the taxpayers to have to foot their defense. I mean, if they get charged with a crime, they should be like you and me, right? I mean, you got to pay for your own lawyer.
That was UH Professor Ken Lawson talking about the far-reaching federal public corruption probe that has touched the city prosecutor's office, the Honolulu Police Department, and now the city's top civil lawyer. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today we're stepping back into the time machine with the date set to 1893 and the location, Chicago. The Columbia Exposition, to be exact. It was said to be the most spectacular World's Fair the world had ever seen. Some say the most spectacular ever. Visitors thrilled to attractions that included the first Ferris wheel, built by George Ferris himself, and the White City, which provided the inspiration for Walt Disney's theme parks over a half a century later. The exhibit of the distant kingdom of Hawaii, whose queen had been deposed earlier that same year, was a major attraction. The exhibit featured a painting of one of Hawaii's most spectacular natural features with live entertainment in the foreground. The music was provided by four native Hawaiian singers. Our backyard quiz question today is, what was the subject of the painting and who painted it? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Stacy Ray from UH Manoa's Department of Theater and Dance. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Been hearing a lot about feral cat problems in our community and have talked about the threat of things like toxoplasmosis in the environment. But today we focus on cat scratch fever. Dr. Jessica Kosit joins us live today to tell us more about what researchers found. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me, Catherine.
Yes. Yeah, so tell our listeners, share with our listeners your position at the UH Medical School and also with Kapi'olani Medical Center.
So I am a pediatric hospitalist at Kapi'olani, which means I take care of hospitalized children. And then I am on the faculty at the School of Medicine and oversee residents and medical students as they rotate through Kapi'olani on their pediatric rotations or in the residency program.
So tell us about this study.
So one of our residents, Scarlett Johnson, myself, and one of our infectious disease specialists, Dr. Natasha Ching, we were noticing increasing numbers of children hospitalized with what we call disseminated cat scratch. So not what we had previously known as regular cat scratch disease, but a far more severe version that was spread further in the body. And when we started noticing that, we said, let's go back and look at our charts. Let's see how many children we've actually seen with this over the last 8 years and try to better understand what these children have and how we treated them, and so that we can, moving forward, set up some guidelines for other clinicians to better diagnose it and better treat it.
Right, because you just looked at numbers at your hospital?
Correct.
So what did you find?
We found that over an eight-year period, we actually had 18 children, 16 of whom were hospitalized for prolonged periods of time, where they had cat scratch involving their liver, their spleen, different parts of bone. Two children had encephalitis, which is an inflammation of the brain, and one child had uveitis, which was inflammation of one of his eyes.
So what is cat scratch fever exactly?
So cat scratch disease is when typically a kitten, but could be an adult cat, scratches someone and basically inoculates them with this bacteria called Bartonella henslei. It then spreads, and usually what we see is inflamed lymph nodes in the area of where the scratch was. So if they get a scratch on the hand, it might be lymph nodes by the elbow or under the arm, or sometimes even as far as the neck. And that's the classic presentation: swollen lymph nodes, fever, some, you know, feeling tired. And they see their doctor and they get put on antibiotics and usually feel better a short time later. for whatever reason, in these children, we're seeing it sort of get past the lymph node gatekeeper, if you will, for the immune system, and it's then getting into the liver, the spleen, the bone, and causing much more severe disease and requiring hospitalization for these children, and then requiring fairly long courses of antibiotics, which in and of themselves can have a lot of side effects.
Now, the numbers, how do they compare with the mainland?
They're 3.5 times as high as what we've seen in a study that was done on the mainland that was actually published by the Centers for Disease Control.
Is this a reportable disease?
It is encouraged to be reported, but not technically one of the ones that we immediately called the Department of Health for.
Now, I recall just growing up when I thought of cat scratch fever, I thought that you had to actually get like bitten by a cat and that it had something to do with what was in his saliva.
So we do think it requires some degree of inoculation, but can be from their claws as well as from their teeth. And so, I think that's what makes it challenging, is that it might be a pretty trivial scratch that ends up resulting in the disease. So often when our patients come to see us, there isn't this recollection of this big bite. It might have just been, you know, a child playing with a cat and getting a little scratch. And then the other thing that makes it difficult is that it's often several weeks later, and particularly for children, they're not going to remember that. And if their, you know, parents aren't on top of them, they're not going to perhaps know about that incident.
So it could be from a pet cat or a feral cat.
Correct. We think typically it's going to be cats that have more fleas, and so typically that's going to be the feral cat population. But it's spread by these fleas, so if you have an outdoor cat, they could be exposed to it as well. Controlling fleas in your cat could definitely make a difference. But yeah, it can be present in your household cat versus feral cats.
But you really don't know.
You really don't know.
I mean, I was in Hawaii Kai, and I was surprised to see coming out at twilight all these eyes across the street at the park and ride. And I drove my car in there and counted some 50 cats just in that one corner. And as I was driving out, there was a whole bunch of more cats coming out of the woodwork because someone was there feeding the cat caregivers. But I was just like, wow, that's a lot of cats.
It is. And we, you know, we have a large feral cat population here, and that was originally documented by some physicians at Tripler about 10 years ago. The Humane Society has worked very hard to do, you know, the spay and neuter and release program in order to control the population. But if these cats already have Bartonella in their system, they're going to continue to spread it as fleas are present. And so that's going to be a difficult thing to control.
Right, and I know the caregivers try to control the colonies and bring the numbers down, but then people, irresponsible pet owners, drop their cats off.
Yes,
you know, and I'm a cat lover. I've had cats, but so it's kind of interesting to learn all these things that we're now finding out about.
Yes, and I, you know, it is hard to want to tell children when a cute cat comes up to you that you don't, you know, instinctively children want a pet, and so do adults. But that there's a risk associated with that, and being aware that they carry disease just like many animals can.
So what's the hope with this research now?
The hope is, one, that we spread awareness amongst families and people, one, to control fleas in their own cats, two, to be, like you described, being responsible animal owners, taking care of your pets and not just letting them go. Trying to work with the Humane Society to limit the population. But then also, if you develop these symptoms, to recognize what those are and be able to tell your physician, because that obviously will make it much easier to make the diagnosis, but also for us to share with clinicians that this is out there. We are seeing a lot more of this, and these are these kind of interesting variations in their presentation. So if you're seeing a child with this and they aren't getting better on what we may consider more traditional antibiotics, to consider this and to send testing for it.
Right, but you looked at a children's cases, but adults too could be.
This would apply to adults as well. I do think, you know, we typically see the vulnerable populations as being the young and the elderly, but a lot of these things will apply to adults in the same way, and the antibiotic treatment choices are very similar.
Okay, so arm ourselves with education. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
We've been chatting with Dr. Jessica Kosett of the University of Hawaii School of Medicine and from the Kapi'olani Medical Center about why Hawaii's cases of cat scratch fever are so high compared to the rest of the country. I'm Catherine Cruz. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR1.
Asia Gamble is one of the few active female slack key artists in the islands. She's also a singer-songwriter who uses her music to tell the stories of her time and perpetuate the Hawaiian language. Join us for her Atherton studio debut on the 26th. Reserve your seats for this concert by Na Hoku and Grammy nominee Asia Gamble at hprtickets.org. Discounted prices for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's now time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. A day after the Hawaii legislative session opens, the governor's still shuffling his cabinet. Politics and opinion editor Chad Blair is on the line with us with a story about Governor David Ige's former chief of staff, Mike McCartney. Hi there.
Good. Hey, good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good. So this is really kind of an interesting lineup. He's been kind of putting out press releases over the last couple of weeks, announcing his picks for his cabinet, and Mike McCartney. Where's Waldo, right? Where's Mike going?
This press release came out just before the House and Senate opened for business yesterday. So, you know, it comes out at this time where everybody else is focused on what the Speaker and the President are going to say. And actually the part about Fort Fuchigami is down at the bottom, same with Mike McCartney. But Mike McCartney has been appointed by the governor to be head of DBED, Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. So that begs the question, what are you going to do with the chief of staff position? Well, the press release didn't say, but yesterday at the governor's office, reporters were there to speak to him after opening day. And he said, essentially, what will happen is Fort Fuchigami will continue to be administrative director. That was in the press release. But would also take on the duties of chief of staff, sort of a double job. And that was a little bit of a surprise, in part because it wasn't actually made clear in the press release. But the governor felt it was an important thing. He thinks Fort Fuchigami is doing a terrific job for his cabinet. And he thinks Mike McCartney, with his experience, should lead DBED.
That is really interesting because you kind of wonder, well, did he not have anyone else to slip into that position and is asking Mike to take over the reins there?
Right. And he actually appointed Ford Fuchigami to be administrative director about, I don't know, year and a half ago. The position didn't actually exist. I do not remember the position the last couple of governors anyway. And if you looked at the governor's website where he lists all his cabinet and staff, Ford was on top of Mike in terms of order of rank. Who knows? Maybe it was alphabetical. I don't know. But that seems to be the case. I do know that Scott Sike, the Speaker, Sylvia Luke, the finance chair in the House, had some concerns about who speaks for the administration. You can't really have two people doing that. It's much better to have one person being your right-hand person, if you will, for the governor. And so going forward, that seems to be the case. I should say that Fort Fuchigami does not require Senate confirmation, but Mike McCartney will as a cabinet appointee.
And the governor is facing some strained relations with the leadership in both the House and Senate. I'm just wondering if the relationship might be better with Ford versus Mike.
You know, Ron Cochi actually made a point of talking to reporters yesterday, the Senate president, saying, look, I'm tired of the media keeps bringing up this tension between the House and Senate leadership. Let's move on. Yes, some of them, the top leaders, actually did endorse Colleen Hanabusa in the Democratic primary over Governor Ige. But Cochi at least said, look, I've been talking to the governor, and there are other appointments that have been made, at least three of them, of which we have reported, are potentially in trouble, may not have the votes to pass the Senate. But Cochi said he's in discussion with Ige and presumably Fort Fuchigami to work out those differences.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I know I was downstairs in the Legislative Reference Bureau asking about when the directories were going to be out, and they said, well, we haven't even got the list for the cabinet members, so that maybe past April, you know, after the session's over.
They usually have those out late January, early February. Those are nice little guides for
yeah.
all of us.
So they don't know what to do. And over at Honolulu Hale, they're not really sure who's representing East Honolulu. So
yeah, District 4, everything's on hold. It's just crazy what's been going on.
Yeah, they don't have their calendars ready either.
That's our job, just to cover all this craziness.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks so much, Chad. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Catherine. Bye-bye.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Hawaii is an expensive place to reach. Flying to the mainland or even inter-island can be a costly proposition for anyone needing to travel. The 27-day partial government shutdown isn't going to make it any cheaper. Brent Spencer is a retired air traffic controller and a professor in Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Air Traffic Management Program. He told HPR's Ryan Finnerty that if the shutdown extends for weeks or even months, consumers will likely see higher prices and flight delays.
Well, there's multiple entities involved. The airport itself is owned by the city or some type of public municipality situation, so the some of the services are provided locally by those people or contract people, like fueling of airplanes and that kind of stuff. That's all handled by a local group that's run through, like, the airport authority. Your TSA, that's a government agency, and you know how they handle the people in the airport, the security people. And then the air traffic control portion is handled by the Federal Aviation Administration, is done by federal air traffic controllers. Your local level stuff, I don't expect that there's really much of an impact with the shutdown on that stuff because it doesn't go through the federal government. The TSA and the air traffic control portions, they are impacted to some extent because those are federal employees.
We've heard a little bit about the TSA, how that's been impacted, so I'd like to focus on the FAA side. What federal employees that work at an airport are FAA employees?
Well, it depends on the size of the airport. Some of the smaller airports around the country are handled by contract control towers. They have a contract with the federal government to provide tower air traffic control services that has to do with runways at small airports, clearing them for takeoff, clearing them to land, and stuff like that. Right now, there's probably no impact on those guys. Their contract's still in place. Those guys are still getting paid. That's a really tiny percentage of the air traffic control workforce, though. Most of your airports, all the ones that are run by the FAA, even some small ones that don't have radar facilities, and, of course, all of the larger ones, those are all federal employees. They're considered critical employees, and those guys are expected to go, and ladies are expected to go to work, whether they're currently getting paid or not.
Can you tell us a little bit about what an air traffic controller actually does, Brent? What's going on inside that tower?
Okay, well, when you talk about air traffic control, people tend to think of just the tower controllers because that's visible to the public. They can see those guys. The tower's sticking up in the air. They can see people up there working. Those guys actually are only a small portion of the air traffic control workforce also. All they are basically handling is airplanes that are within, 5 miles of the airport, and they're clearing them to land, clearing them to take off, getting them into or onto and off of the runway, basically. The larger percentage of the workforce are working radar environments. Some of those are co-located at the tower with those guys. They're usually at the base of the building, and they're working radar, handling 30 to 50 miles airspace from the airport. And then the rest of the airspace is handled by in-route air traffic controllers that are staged. I think there's 21 different in-route facilities around the country, and they handle everything between all the airports and stuff, from the ground all the way up to infinity.
So the term air traffic controller is sort of an umbrella that encompasses a lot.
It's an umbrella that includes all those different types of air traffic control. Some people are certified just tower guys. Some people are just certified radar. Some people are certified in both. It depends on the specific facility you're working at and what services they provide there.
And, Bren, do you know, are all those different types of employees impacted by this shutdown?
Yeah, all of them that are federal employees are impacted to some extent. Again, the contract ones would not be impacted because they have a contract that's already in place and they're not working directly for the federal government. But that's just a tiny portion that's hardly even worth mentioning. Your commercial flights and your major airports and medium-sized airports, those are all federal employees, and there is an impact to those people on the shutdown. They're basically going to work doing the same thing that they've always been doing, but they have no idea where their next paycheck's going to come from or when they're going to get it.
Brent, what are the safety risks as this shutdown continues to drag on? We're in our fourth week now. It shows no signs of letting up. How long can this be sustained?
Well, to be honest, I don't know that a safety perspective is the best perspective to look at this from. Of course, you want to look at the safety, but the system's set up at some point, you know, if it goes on for years or months or whatever, controllers are going to have to provide for their families, and they're going to have to go out and find other jobs to continue to do that. So if controllers stop going to work, which, again, these are really professional people, and they understand the situation, and although it's hard for them, these guys and ladies are still going to work right now. But when it gets to the point that they're not all showing up for work anymore, the airspace doesn't become less safe because the system's designed to account for things like that, and they just slow down the amount of traffic that's involved. So there will be a significant impact that has to do with delays and an economic impact because there's not as many airplanes flying and stuff like that. But the system and the safety in the system should stay the same. Instead of having, I'll just throw random numbers out here that kind of mean nothing. Instead of an air traffic controller handling, say, 50 airplanes because they have enough people to do that, if they have to combine his airspace with somebody else and he's expected to handle 100 airplanes, they're not going to make him do that. They're going to restrict aircraft on the ground to keep the numbers in the airspace at a safe level.
So we could eventually see increased ticket prices because there will be fewer planes in the air.
Absolutely. There will be an economic impact to more than just the people losing their salaries. At some point, airlines are going to have to start canceling flights. Once you start canceling flights and the demand for seats go up, yep, they're going to get more expensive.
Brent, how long does it take to train a brand new air traffic controller? So if we start to see an exodus from the federal labor force, because as you mentioned, people need to generate income.
That's the real kicker. This is not something that you can train to do someplace else. You can get some training in the military as a controller, in certain types of facilities and stuff. The military doesn't do all the different types of air traffic control that the FAA does. For example, the en route stuff is not, the military en route stuff is handled by civilian controllers. So, and it's a long process. Depending on the facility or the type of facility you go to, once you've gone through basic air traffic training at their FAA Academy, which is in Oklahoma City, that takes 3 to 4 months to go through that. When you leave that, you've just barely started training. Some of the busier facilities take 3 to 5 years to certify it.
And I know that during the air traffic controller strike in the 1980s, military controllers were brought in as a temporary measure. Is that something that could still be done today, or are the systems incompatible?
Well, it could be done as well today as it was done then. That's not really a good thing, though. The problem with doing that, and I actually was in the military when the strike went on before, so I kind of have some firsthand knowledge of this. Air traffic controllers are good with working airplanes, but then you take that controller, put them in a different facility, work in different airspace with different traffic flows and different local regulations and stuff, there's still a huge learning curve. They understand the basics of air traffic control. I mean, controllers move from one facility to the other, but they still have to go through a training process. So, like after the strike, military controllers went in and took over some of those functions. But again, they had to slow things down to the extent that those guys could handle it because they didn't have specific training on the local facilities and traffic procedures.
So it sounds like there are no good options other than
getting... There's no good options. I hate to say that, but there's not any.
That was Brent Spencer, retired air traffic controller and professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Arizona. You can listen back to all our coverage on the local effects of the government shutdown at hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look for special series from The Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, the former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, and author of the bestseller, Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong. And you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In the first half of the show, we asked you what was portrayed in a painting on display at the 1893 Columbia Exposition, better known as the Chicago World's Fair. One contemporary account from a Colonel George R. Davis described the exhibit as, quote, one of the very best attractions at the fair. Located near the Ferris wheel in the entertainment district, the main feature was a cyclorama of Kilauea volcano painted by Chicago artist Walter Burridge. Another highlight was a live Hawaiian music provided by a quartet of musicians. Colonel Davis also observed that when looking upon the great painting of the volcano and hearing native songs, it makes one feel as though they were in reality in faraway Hawaii. And we stumped you on that question. No winners today. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, please send it to Hawaii Talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Without a doubt, Says You is the toughest quiz show on the air and one of the funniest forms of recreational thinking. What's the difference between a spade and a shovel?
A spade and a shovel.
Okay, how about my cats are spade, but they're not shovel.
Unless you have a real lot of cats.
Yeah, right. Lots of real big cats.
Right. Spirited and civil, brainy and boisterous, Says You.
This evening at 6:30.
Love craft beer and spirits in general? Well, thinking about trying your hand at the brewing business? Well, we sat down with Steve Humshill, the man behind Lanikai Brewing Company, who says he has the best job in the world, and he wants to share what he's learned about the regulatory side of the business with others.
Craft beer brewing is all about collaborative. It's all about partnering and sharing, and it's really easy when we run out of grain or we need a supply. We contact one of our competitors and say, hey, can I borrow that from you, or do you need something that we can help you with, or can we reduce costs by shipping all of our stuff together in one container? So beer in general is very collaborative, and so this approach to be able to teach people about the business of beer kind of is along that ethos.
And what got you into this?
Into beer?
Yeah.
Who doesn't love beer? Initially, when I first was introduced to beer, I learned how to do it at my house. And I knew how to repair surfboards, and a friend knew how to produce beer. So they take about the same amount of time. And we couldn't find beer, at least for us, that represented Hawaii. So we wanted beer that infused local flavors heavily in every single beer that we could have. So that was kind of the genesis of ours, is we started discovering the different flavors of Hawaii and trying to make authentic Hawaiian beer. And at the same time, we were kind of repairing surfboards, and then that would kind of repeat itself. So we would go surf, break boards, drink the beer we had just made, make new beer, surf again. And that kind of continued on for a number of years before I decided really to go down the path of opening a commercial brewery.
And you learned some good lessons in the process.
You do, yeah. What most people don't realize is beer and alcohol in general is a federal product. It's federally regulated. So you have the, ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and there's a subsection of that called the TTB that looks at everything from the recipes that you formulate to your labels to make sure that it's a consumer safety issue. So then from the federal side, it goes down to the state side, and state goes into city and county, and then you have all the different departments that you're regulated by. So it's quite a heavy laundry list that most people don't realize the amount of regulation that goes into every single beer or spirit or wine that's produced.
And that's what you hope to kind of cover in this class.
Yeah, exactly. So the general process of the course is really that we want to help people, not teach them how to produce beer or wine or spirits, that's their responsibility, but just to help them through the business hurdles so that they recognize what their expenses are, what their regulatory compliance can be, and things that are more directly associated with the business of producing craft liquor, wine, beer.
And most people think of beer, but we have companies that are doing other things. You've got a rum company, vodka, wine.
Yeah, for sure. Craft kind of represents kind of small entrepreneurial, small batch basis. Back in the historical days, there would be a brewery on every single corner. And when you would, at the end of your workday, that's where you would go drink beer, and you wouldn't have these national brands. And so craft beer means it's not corporate owned. It's generally not distributed nationwide, although there are some, but it's really more about supporting local entrepreneurs and and the business of craft everything have been exploding, and beer has probably been the champion right now. You know, beer is fermented, and then spirits are fermented, then distilled. So there are different regulatory compliances that you need from either the label side or from your production side that could impact your compliance with those laws.
You're really then providing the roadmap that you didn't have when you started.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would love to see more breweries. I'd love to see more distilleries and wineries. I would love to see more of those in Hawaii. And it's my opinion that a lot of people are there. Like I said, there's no roadmap. So there's no way to know that you're, even if you're a good actor and you want to be compliant with everything, you don't always know what you haven't, you know, what permit that you didn't submit for. And sometimes a lot of it just comes at you later on in the game. And to open up a craft anything, a craft producer, is very expensive. You're a manufacturing facility. And if you're not aware and you can't plan your business accordingly, then you could end up either going bankrupt or all these things. And I would hate to see anybody that is as dedicated and passionate about a product that I am go down that path only to realize that they ran out of money or that they couldn't do it.
So we often hear that Hawaii has a very anti-business climate. But this is one thing that you're trying to do to kind of help people get started.
Yeah, or just be able to help them better analyze that opportunity for themselves. If they look at it and look at the complications and that roadmap and have a nice painted picture in front of them, or the best one that we can, then they can decide if they want to get into the business or not. So we're just trying to be able to provide more information to the consumer, or to the hopefully the future entrepreneur that wants to get into it. So when they're ready to get into it, they have less questions, they have more certainty, their business plan is stronger, and that they can really come in. It's better for the entire industry if businesses don't fail right after they start. So we're just trying to help everybody get a heads up of information up front so then they can start their business.
Okay. And so tell us about the classes. When will they be held and what will be offered?
So there's three different part series of the different classes, and the first one's coming up on the 26th. You can kind of go through and decide. So some deals with kind of marketing and compliance. Some deals with state, some deals with federal. So it can break it down. So if people have general knowledge of some, then they can skip that portion, or they can attend the entire three-part course and get a more comprehensive view. So they can look through everything from trademarking to compliance, licensing, anything that they feel that they need to like learn more or want to at least have access to somebody who's gone down that road before.
Do these classes then get you some kind of special certification?
It is a certificate. You do get a certificate in the end. But really what we're trying to provide is confidence to the people to be able to decide if they want to open that business or not, so they can really have a good understanding of what it is.
What do you think was probably the most difficult thing for you as someone who has decided, hey, I'm going to do beer?
I guess what I never realized is how long the runway takes to get licensed. And luckily, we had in all of our projections, we had kind of padded them. So we did all right. But it can take 8 months to 2 years to get your license. But during that time, you're paying for you're leasing a facility, and it's generally manufacturing, so you need a large facility. And then lease costs in Hawaii are very large. So, you know, every month you're shelling out, you know, could be tens of thousands of dollars while you're waiting for that license to produce. So you have a large financial cash outlay at the beginning. And then your hope is that you'll continue to be successful and then recuperate that later down the line. So to me, that was I really didn't believe it was going to take as long as it did. And it does. It's, as you mentioned, Hawaii's not the most business-friendly state. So there's things that are very slow to move, or people are on vacation. And then you also have the federal side and the state and the city and county and everything that gets involved.
I know I did see something on the news about how this federal shutdown has affected some small brewers.
Yeah, I'm one of them right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we have beers that any beer that uses exotic ingredients besides kind of a laundry list of a short one has to be approved federally, your recipe. So we have beers whose recipes have been submitted that, you know, since those employees aren't allowed to work, we're not getting approvals for those. And then the corresponding labels then haven't been approved. So we have beer that's made and ready to go to market, but our labels are not approved by the Fed, and neither is our recipe. So we're just kind of trapped in limbo waiting to release beers.
So how long is this beer good for?
It depends. All styles of beer are different. You know, some beers can age beautifully over 7-8 years. Some are designed to drink fresh.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not so much like your product is going to spoil, but you just want to be able to get it to market and get out there to be sold and enjoyed.
Yeah, I just want to share beer. That's all I want to do. Yeah.
So is this a big hiccup for you? I mean, I don't know. You have probably other product that's out there good to go.
We work with a lot of exotic ingredients, so we're used to kind of the slow process, and we plan ahead. So it won't – I mean, we'll still – all the beers that we've produced so far, we'll still be able to produce those. This is just kind of new beers that we haven't made yet. So we're slightly impacted, but it's not gonna stop us from keeping the lights on and making sure employees are paid and things like that.
Okay. And yeah. Then you mentioned that you're also in the process of putting a distillery together.
Correct.
To do spirits?
Yep, to do spirits, ciders, and then maybe champagne as well. Yeah, and that's kind of in process as well. But those licenses are also kind of bogged down by the shutdown at this time. Yeah.
Anyone interested in the University of Hawaii course that Hamshel will be teaching should think about registering right away. The course starts on January 26th and runs 3 weekends. The deadline to sign up for the course is next Tuesday, January 22nd. Find links on our Facebook page, The Conversation HPR. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, a call-in show about our homeless problem. Next week begins the point-in-time count across the country, and volunteers are still needed. Tell us what's on your mind. Call or talk back line. Leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.